Hi, it's Patrick here in the World Newsroom in Boston, and we have another little newsy pod today. We have five stories vacuumed in from obscure parts of the internet. So, coming up, new slangy words for Scrabble, new research about the origins of the Japanese language, research, both new and old, funded by the Pentagon, including something called the Metaphor Program. Also, Barack Obama's bilingual upbringing in his early years, English at home, Indonesian at school, and a brief introduction to robots with the charming name of Lingo Droids. Okay, so here I am with cartoon queen Carol Hills, we're flying Carol today engineerless.
Whoa.
We have no engineer. We're engineering ourselves.
We're going commando.
In a little windowless self-op. Who knows what could be going on out there in the real world. We just wouldn't know.
No.
Let's just talk about language instead.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the first story that we're going to talk about today. What's that?
Well, the first story, I can sum it up in three words. Fang, in it, girl.
Oh, girl.
There are three of among about 3,000 words that were added to the official Collins Dictionary.
Hmm.
Collins puts out a special dictionary for Scrabble, and they've added 3,000 words. They're a big combination between kind of the techno scene, the hip-hop groovy scene, and just words that have come into being. And so, thang, in it, and girl are among them.
They seem almost retro, actually, those all three of those.
Well, I have to confess that I had to look them up. So it just means that your language pod newscast partner is retro.
Oh, right. Well, thang is, wasn't that like 70s. I think that started in the 70s.
It's your
I
don't know thing. If it was really,
yeah.
Do what you want to do.
Yeah. Girl is 90s, right?
Girl.
It's like the whole Olympia, like angry girl rock scene and all of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It seems to be that, though there's some disagreement, and some people are as baffled as I am. So that made me feel better. And then in it is part of.
It's Brit.
It's sort of part isn't part it, isn't it?
Right. Isn't it?
Yeah. Isn't it?
In it. That's what you're saying. And then the interesting way in which in it evolved was it ceased to have any meaning as isn't it, and it just became this thing that you said at the end of a sentence. I can't remember what the linguists call that, but it was just this sort of way of just filling time.
Like A in Canada? A?
I suppose that's what it would be. So, you know, here I'd be telling you something, Carol. In it! And it would have no grammatical value to my saying in it, but yeah, it sounds nice.
Well, you know, it's interesting because this has caused a big controversy or just chewing it over in Britain. And at least one article I read, half of all households in Britain have Scrabble.
Do they?
That's what this article says. Another one says in the U.S., not surprisingly, only a quarter.
Oh, right. Of those households, I suppose I must have been to many. None of them have got their Scrabble sets out when I've been there.
It's kind of amazing, but there's other words like there's drug words. Again, I'm so retro, I don't know what they mean. Tick, gack, and tina.
Oh, I don't know what those are either.
I don't either. And there's a lot of Indian cookery words like keema, aloo, or bogai.
Hmm.
But there's a lot of kind of hand-wringing in the blogosphere and in a lot of the British papers. Some people saying, oh, what are we doing this for? It's just slang, and this is spoken, and Scrabble should be written, and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And then others saying, oh, get off it. It's just the language is alive, it morphs, and this is how it's always been.
Well, and also, Scrabble's a game, people.
Exactly. Everybody... And Scrabble itself, apparently the word, you know, was first used in the King James Bible, and it was spelled S-C-R-A-B-L-E.
Well, they didn't know how to spell in those days.
They just made it up. But you know what? I have some useless facts to throw in just because I thought they were so cool.
Mm.
So the Scrabble story, it's like the Starbucks story. It's like the McDonald's story. It's one of these things where somebody started it, but it was somebody else who made it hugely popular.
Mm.
Some guy, some architect created this, I guess around the 1930s, and it was called Lexico. And the architect's name was a good Scrabble proper noun, but I guess can't use those. But it's Alfred Mosher Butts was the architect who came up with what we now know as Scrabble.
Right.
But
that's a lot of points, right?
That is, yeah. But he called it Lexico, and then he called it crisscross words. But he wasn't able, you know, he got it started and somebody else sort of had it, and then they weren't able, it became really popular at a certain point because it was mentioned in some newspaper or something, and everybody did it. But they couldn't keep up with production, so somebody else bought it, and then it exploded. Mm. And then it's gone through company to company, and then it's ended up at Hasbro, which is just down the road in Rhode Island. And the word Scrabble, it means, it's a real word that means to scratch frantically.
Oh! Well, there you go. It's a sound effect, no less, in this engineerless studio. Wow, that's a lot of really interesting stuff. Thank you, Carol. That's great. And apropos, actually, of Brits using words in strange ways and all of that, I came across a headline, a BBC headline. This was actually via our friends at LanguageLog. Astonishing thing. It's BBC London website. And the headline goes like this. Ben Douglas, BAFTA race row hairdresser James Brown story. So that is what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. No, sorry. The last word was sorry, not story. That is 9 nouns, or at least 9 verbless words.
That's rather odd. And do you know what it means?
No. Well, I do now because I read the story. But when I first came across this thing, I was just, what on earth is this about? This is where BAFTAs are the British equivalent of, is it the Oscars?
The Oscars?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I think so. So Ben Douglas is saying sorry over a row, a British argument, to do with race and a hairdresser and James Brown.
James Brown, the late performer-singer, or is the hairdresser named James Brown?
Yeah, could be. I didn't get that far into the story. But anyway, Ben Douglas is a sorry man, but he's sorry without
a verb.
He's verblessly sorry. But anyway, good on you. I think that probably, had that gone out on a broader BBC platform, there might have been
They might have added a verb.
Yeah. But there you go. Anyway. All right. Well, on to story number two.
Story number two. Let's have it.
Story number two is about the Japanese language. And this is interesting insofar as the origins of the language are much debated. It's the main global language for which we don't really have any explanation of where it came from. There are two main theories. Up until now, there have been two main theories. One has been very much in vogue in Japan ever since the Second World War, and that is that Japanese arose indigenously from the collection of islands that is Japan today from more than 10,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, something like that. There wasn't a huge amount of evidence for that, but there was some anecdotal evidence that was generally accepted. And of course, it kind of fits into a kind of soft nationalism and a sense that, you know, for an island nation, the language arose from the people who'd been there all of this time. The other theory, which was one that was has kind of come back and forth in Japanese history, is politicians have tended to embrace it when they felt the nationalist need to do so, as they did when they invaded Korea and mainland China, was that the language was brought over from mainland Asia, and that therefore invading these places again was a way of not so much expanding the Japanese empire as just going back to the places where, you know, Japan originated from, or the Japanese people originated from. Well, that second theory is the one that more and more actually people, not for those political nationalist reasons, but just out of scientific evidence, are now taking a much closer look at and believe is more likely to be the case. About somewhere between 2,400 and 3,000 years ago, and there's some debate over exactly when it was, a large number of farmers, rice farmers, migrated to Japan from the Korean Peninsula. Up until then, Japan had been hunter-gatherer only.
How did they get
somewhat
there?
Late. I was hoping you wouldn't ask that.
Isn't there a body of water?
There is a body of water, and it was not frozen over at that stage. Mm. So I guess they came over in contraptions that float, but
that's all we can guess.
Yeah, that's all I can say. Anyway, along they came and brought with them the language, so the theory went. Nobody could really, this made sense rather than again, there being that much evidence for it. Well, now a study has come out using a very different, a new controversial methodology that's only been used in the last decade or so that borrows from evolutionary genetics insofar as it regards language as having gene-like qualities. The two lead researchers from the University of Tokyo listed just over 200 key pieces of vocabulary, like body parts, basic verbs, numbers, pronouns. And then they duplicated that list across 59 different dialects, Japanese dialects. And then they found that these key vocabulary words, which across the dialects today are considerably varied, descended down to a common ancestor nearly 2,200 years ago, which is a little bit late, but it kind of coincides with this wave of migration from the Korean Peninsula.
Is there have they done genetic mapping, you know, in the way you can do your own genetic map and see where you evolved from? Have they done that to show that the majority of people in Japan come through Asia via Korea?
I bet they have, because there's no, certainly in the reporting that I've seen, what is not in doubt is that this migration took place. What is in doubt is quite how many people came over at that particular time, but they know where they came from, the Korean Peninsula, and they know that, you know, over several generations there were large numbers of them came and completely transformed the way in which civilization functioned from hunter-gatherer to farming, and as a result, the population increased exponentially.
How do those people, isn't there a group of indigenous Japanese, they live up in the north, they're not ethnically what we consider Japanese? Do they have a different language?
They do. They have a language,
Ainu,
I think, yeah. As far as I understand, I'd love to go there, I must say. It's in Hokkaido, the northernmost large island, and their language has got nothing to do with Japanese at all. I think it's another of those languages, although it's a fast-dying language, but it is another of those languages that there's a real mystery about its origin.
Do they use the Japanese characters when they speak? I mean, right?
Now you're asking me questions.
Okay. That's
way
the subject for another podcast. We can do a whole podcast about the weird languages like Basque.
Oh, yeah.
We should do that.
Yeah.
People just don't have a clue where they
came
from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's pretty interesting. Yeah. It also is is that a comeuppance for old, I mean, for a certain dated chauvinism of Japan and a very painful history of colonizing Korea and not treating Korea very well.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, reading about this just made me realize how much theories about language and migration and origin of languages, how much they're manipulated by politicians and, you know, demagogues. Based on one scant piece of evidence, you could create an entire theory, a rabble-rousing theory as to, you know, the beginnings of your people. It seems as though the Japanese people in particular have been done a disservice by various politicians over time.
Yes.
And now they're only just beginning to come to grips with their own language.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move along swiftly then to story number three, and that is yours, Carol.
Story number three is just kind of a couple interesting observations, really. And one of them is how much things have changed since 9/11, which is almost 10 years ago now. There's a couple interesting kind of entries and blog entries or articles about people involved in high security things, DARPA. Do you remember what DARPA is? It's that
National
Security Agency.
It's the research arm of the Pentagon, which isn't quite accurate because they have it's a research arm of the Pentagon, but maybe it's the biggest.
Well, there was an interesting reflection by someone who worked for DARPA, maybe still does, and where they were on 9/11. And they were on their way to a meeting about this project, DARPA project called TIDES, which is Translingual Information Detection, Extraction, and Summarization. And the goal of TIDES is to revolutionize the way that information is obtained from human language by enabling people to find and interpret needed information quickly and effectively, regardless of language or medium. So what was interesting is the person who wrote this, they were on their way to a meeting in Arlington, Virginia, 9/11. They're completely derailed. They can't get there. They're just watching the news. But this person recalled that at that time, the big languages that they were really on the front burner, the featured languages to really explore, exploit, be at the ready in every possible way.
At the Pentagon.
At the Pentagon. Mandarin, Korean, and Spanish. And I bet you can guess almost 10 years later, or even not even 10 years later, practically the day after, the focus of this TIDES project changed to what language, Patrick?
Well, I would say Arabic, Pashto, Farsi, and we'll keep Mandarin in there too. And
basically, yeah, Arabic.
Mm.
I mean, from news text to creating an English parallel text to Arabic lexicons, broadcast, conversational speak, the whole thing. And as you know from lots of stories and research into language, the government can't give away enough money for the study of Arabic. And if someone can utter half a sentence and is in a public school or public institution, they could get government money to study it. The government is so desperate for skilled Arabic speakers, preferably, in many ways, non-native Arabic speakers for other more nuanced reasons. But then there was another fun item. This is kind of not fun, but it's sort of interesting. When Osama bin Laden was killed, was it just last month?
Yep.
It was in May. Yeah, I can't believe it. Anyway, just last month when Osama bin Laden is killed, there's a sort of interesting practice at the New York Times of when you use the honorific Mr. And there's inconsistencies about it. And it came up around bin Laden because the New York Times, when they reported the news, he was Mr. bin Laden. His obituary dropped the Mr. And technically, I think in terms of online, somebody documented that he was Mr. until his body hit the water, basically, when they were disposing of his body.
Yeah.
And this article was all about the New York Times guidelines for using Mr. and where they have been inconsistent. Technically, when a historic figure who is not loathed dies, they are Mr. until they die. And then they're just referred to their last name. But there are still instances where former President Ronald Reagan is called Mr. Reagan. And there's still interest. And then, the old chestnut, Dr. Martin Luther King. He's been dead for over 40 years. He's still Dr. Martin Luther King. The honorific has not been dropped. And there's interesting inconsistencies in that, say, Bill Bradley, former senator from New Jersey, also a pro basketball player. When he was an athlete, an active athlete, he was Bradley. He became Mr. Bradley.
Mm-hmm.
When he became a senator, he's still Mr. But there's a couple of bad guys, just universally accepted bad guys, who never got a Mr. Mm. even when they were alive. Hitler. He was never Mr.
Never
Hitler,
got a
even
Mr.
when he was alive. He never got a Mr. And either did one of his famous generals, Erwin Rommel, the Desert Fox. He was just Rommel, even when he was alive.
He didn't even get a general or anything?
I don't know. That they're saying he didn't get anything.
Huh.
And Pol Pot, he got a Mr., but his obituary was just Pol Pot.
Back to Pol Pot, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm astonished that Pol Pot got a Mr. and Erwin Rommel didn't.
Yes.
And Osama bin Laden had a Mr. for quite a long time. The inconsistencies all the way around. It just goes to show, as soon as you have rules, you can't really, it's impossible to enforce them.
And interestingly, Joseph Stalin and Idi Amin, they were Mr. Stalin and Mr. Amin. And there was this transition period, the obit, maybe a month of Mr. after they die, and then they're off. But bin Laden, he got no transition. His body hits the water, that Mr.'s
he's
gone.
He's done, yeah.
He's done.
So what do they do with, Sting or Bono or something? How are they referred to?
They get their one-namer thing.
There's no question of,
You'd never
Mr.
say
Sting.
Mrs. Cher.
depending on whether divorce
Mr.
proceeding was, Mr. Sting. So what? They're breaking their own rule there.
Yeah.
Right. To account. Yeah.
I mean, if you were calling up Sting, and somebody answered the phone, would you say, "May I speak to Sting," or would you say, "May I speak to Mr. Sumner," or would you say,
"Oh, I don't. Is that his name?
Gordon Sumner."
Oh,
isn't
I see. That's his name. All right.
What would you say? Like Snoop Dogg. Call up Snoop Dogg. Do you say, "May I speak to
Mr. Dogg? I think he'd quite like that, wouldn't he? Well, Mr. T. Mr. Odorizer, Mr. T, but I was thinking of iced tea.
I think all these things, like everything about language, all the changes are accelerating with online life.
Yeah.
Just everything is changing. And all of the, that's, and everything online has creeped into print, which is, they're more and more of the same thing.
Right.
But you know what I mean? The conversationality, which was changing anyway. The language was becoming much less formal even before the web, and now it's just accelerating. Informality.
I've certainly found that, you know, just doing the podcast has made me less formal when it comes to doing a story for the big show. I'm just,
same with me, because recording these things, there's nobody here listening. It's not
with
yet.
No editor breathing down one's neck. We really are. I mean, not only, you know, no editor, no engineer, no nobody. Yeah.
I heard somebody refer to podcasts as radio without listeners.
Yeah, that's right. It's the trifecta, really, isn't it? No editor, no engineer, no listeners. Prove us wrong. Just going back to the DARPA thing for 1 minute, I did also see a story about another research arm of the government. This time it's the intelligence community. IARPA. The Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity, which is starting something called the Metaphor Program.
Ooh.
Which is, this is a way in which metaphors can be, this is a classic American thing, metaphors can be collected from around the world. Foreign language metaphors can be collected and presumably inputted and, you know, have the meanings wrung out of them by some gargantuan computer. So when, you know, the stuff that we're scared of out there is monitored, we can understand exactly the nuance of the language through our understanding of the metaphors. Because we all agree that, firstly, that we all speak metaphorically. Every language, you know, has a strong metaphorical side to it. And also that's the most, it's often the most difficult part of a foreign language to grasp, especially if you're a computer.
Yes.
So on the face of it, I guess it's a good idea. It certainly sounds
really
like,
careful.
Yeah, you have to be really careful. I mean, of course, you know, as somebody who likes to learn foreign languages myself, I think, yes, of course, metaphors, foreign metaphors, as difficult as they are something that you really strive for, and they're often steeped in idiom. They often are idiom. And once you've mastered that, you feel a real sense of accomplishment and as if you've got a piece of the culture as well as the language and all of that. But if you're not so much learning a language as trying to, as basically spying on people.
Spying on their metaphors.
Spying on their metaphors. That's a whole different ball of wax. You know, aside from the creepy side, as you say, it could be open to huge misinterpretation.
Like a stuffed shirt. Is there a bomb in the shirt? What's going on? I mean, is the goal to be able to extract coded languages, or is it simply becoming so proficient that you get the vernacular and you get the metaphors?
Well, both in a way, because all language is coded and the code is metaphor. I mean, I suppose it's a way of interpreting the code of spoken and email language as metaphor. And if you can crack that metaphorical code, then you know how people are thinking and how people are receiving that information.
Oh, okay.
You know, whether it's emails distributed among people who wish harm on the United States, or whether it's just somebody giving a speech somewhere. I mean, we all laugh when we see, for example, with North Korea, and, you know, North Korean TV news is just completely over the top. And when there's a speech from a North Korean official or Kim Jong-il or whoever, there's this flourish that is quite extraordinary when it's translated into English. And even, I mean, I was in South Korea, and it's even pretty extraordinary by South Korean standards, even, you know, the same language. But it makes total sense to North Koreans. And if we could pass that through the metaphors that are used, then, you know, that would be very helpful, I guess. Yeah, so, well, there we go. I should introduce story number two now. And that is, well, it's really the story of Barack Obama's early life and his introduction to foreign culture and foreign language through his mother. And this comes as a result of the biography of his mother that has just come out by Jani Scott. It's called, what's it called?
A Singular Woman.
Singular Woman. Anyway, there are enough details now emerging with this biography, along with what we already know about the early life of Barack Obama, that seem to be worth noting. You know, he had a Kenyan father, he had a American mother, they got divorced very quickly in his infancy, and then she moved the family, she moved him from the United States to Indonesia. And so he spent his first few years of school, first, second, third, and fourth grade. Yeah, fourth grade at two Indonesian language schools. One was a Catholic school, one was a Muslim school. The language of instruction in both cases was Indonesian, which, I mean, it's a long time.
It is.
The current president of the United States was learning in Indonesian. He was also learning English. He spoke English with his mother, who herself spoke quite a lot of Indonesian as a result of the work that she did. But she introduced him to English, had these correspondence courses sent to her, and so he would listen to recordings of Mahalia Jackson and also Martin Luther King. So he was well-versed in some pretty nice English, American English. And it wasn't until fifth grade that he actually enrolled in a school in Hawaii, where he then stayed and got the rest of his schooling. But those first 4 years were Indonesian, and when he went back last year to Indonesia, he used an awful lot of Indonesian in his speeches, and he'd done a little bit of that before in an interview or two that he'd done with Indonesian reporters, but this really was a big deal for Indonesians.
Yes.
And he used a lot, you know, he used a lot of slang. It's sort of kind of acceptable slang, not dirty slang or anything, but street slang. He used the kind of slang that made it clear to Indonesians that back in the day, you know, he would have bought food and drink from a street stall or what, you know, what have you. So yeah, actually, here's a little bit of Barack Obama speaking Indonesian.
Assalamualaikum dan salam sejahtera. Thank you for this wonderful welcome. Thank you to the people of Jakarta, and thank you to the people of Indonesia. Pulang kampung ni.
You know, he said a whole load of things over there. One of the things that he said that was particularly popular was something that translates to Indonesia is a part of me. Clearly, that's going to go very well. And he said that very well, apparently. He got good reviews on various blogs. Indonesians wrote on American blogs to say sort of, you know, how good.
Give a report card on his
Indonesian. Yeah, yeah. Minor stumbles in pronunciation and delivery, I'm quoting here. And here's another one. He's more than halfway competent in conversational Indonesian, as evidenced by his idiomatic ad-lib, inak ya. I don't know if that's the way you say it, but that he said that at one point. His pronunciation was generally on target, this person goes on to say, except for minor problems in some of the longer, more formal words. Not surprising, considering he was 10 years old when he left Indonesia. So, I mean, I don't know if he did a little bit of cramming before he went over there. And, you know, it just strikes me as just such a great thing for, you know, a president. It's not, and it also puts into context a little bit the comments that he has made about how important it is for Americans to learn more foreign languages. And a lot of that came from his mom, who was very unlike your regular moms in Indonesia, American moms in Indonesia. She didn't hang out with the other Americans. She somewhat disdained them, said that they weren't sort of
They weren't interested in where they were. They were interested in the people of Indonesia.
They were just in their bubble, including a linguistic bubble. And, you know, she went out and did she did an anthropological PhD.
She did. She studied about, you know, the crafts, certain crafts business. She did a PhD eventually.
Yeah.
How certain crafts were around the economy of
home. There was also a really funny little story in the biography about her, of her Indonesian, when she was fairly early on in the time she was over there, and she didn't have the full mastery of the language that she had later. And she was running a program for, I guess, English teaching that was run by USAID in Jakarta. And she apparently told this story a lot herself after the fact. She found it amusing that she would make a slip-up such as this. She was trying to tell one of her Indonesian students that he would get a promotion if he learned English. And instead of using the phrase I don't know how to pronounce this, sorry people, Nike Pankat. She said Nike Pantat. And the word Nike means go up or rise or mount. And Pankat means rank, mm-hmm. which is the right one. Unfortunately, Pantat means buttocks. So great mirth, no doubt, among her Indonesian students at that point. But yeah, there's a nice linguistic side to this new biography of Anne Dunham.
Yes, it's everything that's come out, this new biography and all the reviews and long essays that have responded to it, it's very interesting, and you realize how successful, or I'm not sure that's the right word, but the way she was portrayed in the presidential campaign was completely different.
Oh, yeah, the woman from Kansas.
It was all about Kansas and her parents, you know, working, father serving in the war and the war effort at home and Heartland. And I had such a different image of her sort of a naive American. And the way she's described, at least the evidence of her life, where the choices she made and what she did, she was on the vanguard, very, very different in all sorts of ways from her contemporaries. I mean, she grew up in a very, she's 1962. Yeah. I think Barack Obama was born in 1962. She was married to an African student, and everything about her, she sort of chafed under this kind of expat community in Indonesia, and she was quite interesting.
Well, there you go. Obama, Indonesian, multilingualism, and all of that. On to stories. How public radio can you get? Okay. Better get on to some, you know.
Some important things.
Some important stuff. Uh-huh. Story number one.
Story number one is, I'm not sure I buy the whole thing, but let me tell you about it. This woman, this researcher at the University of Queensland in Australia, her name is Ruth Schultz. She and her team and her lab have developed these robots that they call Lingo Droids. I am a Lingo Droid. The goal of her research is to try to make robotic language more nuanced, create robots that can articulate more abstractly and can also receive information more abstractly to make them more useful to humans. That's the goal. To understand what they did, basically, imagine that you wake up, you have no memory, and you don't know any languages. You have no memory of your life at all, and you don't have any way to express anything around you. And then you happen to stumble across somebody else just like that. This is how she's going about creating these robots. And how you might communicate, and how she's teaching the robots to communicate, is you and I might come across each other. We have no memory of anything. We don't know any language. We're in this room, and I might tap on a table and then utter some word, bleh. And then by me pointing at it and saying, bleh, that becomes the word for table. Mm. In many of the ways that you think of a toddler learning language, that very primal thing, there's something that represents a sound. So that's what she's teaching these robots.
So they're programmed to listen and lock into a certain sound equating to a certain object.
Yes. They're sort of programmed to make up a word with a kind of preset group of syllables that they have in them. Hmm. And then the other one repeats it. And then basically they have this word for something. And so they're sort of creating this language. And she has them do sort of robot games with each other to see how many words they can come up with. They move around. And I actually... And so I emailed her and I said, is there any sound of this? So she sent me a little piece of video of during a robot game of them talking to each other and making up little words or saying things. Here's what it sounds like. These are two robots and they're moving around, beeping, but these beeps, they're subtitles that represent the words. And that's the part I'm not clear about. And she also sent me her dissertation.
I'm not clear about that.
But I know one thing. Those robots aren't going to be able to repeat that dissertation. But anyway. So I'm just going to read one gist of what they're finding out. And this is from the article that was written. From this fundamental base, the robots can play games with each other to reinforce the language. For example, one robot might tell the other robot, Kuzo, and then both robots will race to where they think Kuzo is. So they learn the word, and then they also, if you say it back, then they, if the word represents a place, they go...
They go there. Oh,
right, right. When they meet at or close to the same place, that reinforces the connection between a word and a location. And from Kuzo, one robot can ask the other about the place they just came from, resulting in words for more abstract concepts like direction and distance. So they're sort of trying to get more and more specific and more subtle with the kind of words they're developing.
So they've reached the kind of cognitive level of your average drunk soccer fan by now.
A little bit more than that. Maybe a few more words than that.
Less violent.
You know, the whole idea is making robots more useful, them more textured and layered in terms of how they digest information and how they communicate with humans. So it isn't
right.
just kind of, you know.
Right, and that seems to be very much the point of this, rather than some kind of way to try and figure out something fundamental about language.
Yes, it's a functional thing.
Yeah.
It's a functional thing. The thing I don't quite get, and maybe I'll email her about this, is what our listeners will see if you look at the video, which is the two robots are speaking to each other, beeping, and then she has written in the subtitles. So I don't know how she knows that the means these words. Like one of them is, well, thank you very much. Nice to see you. I don't get that piece of it. But she is trying to push the envelope in terms of robot
It's like a movie with
language.
Both dubbing and subtitles or something.
Nice to see you.
But no, that would be good to know.
You know, the whole thing is kind of making them less like robots, I guess, is the thing. Where
you know, I think
the more
you try to make a robot human, the less human it is. You know, whether it's HAL or, you know, Daleks or what have you. I mean, the moment you give them a voice, they just completely betray their robotness, which is quite delightful, but it's not human. In a way, if they just kept their mouths or whatever those orifices that they have shut, then maybe they could get away with being a little, they could be more cuddly, but somehow.
Well, I know in other stories we've covered on the big show, and maybe you've stumbled across them too, there are a lot of hopes for robots in national defense in terms of going in and doing the dirty work that we don't want humans to do.
Yeah.
That part would be interesting. And given the fog of war, they would need to be pretty flexible.
Absolutely.
And pretty, you know, three-dimensional.
Absolutely,
and get stuff. So.
Yes.
There are a lot of real-world kind of situations where you don't want humans to go into kind of danger that you send a robot in. That's going to require a whole different level of communicating and understanding.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
That's all I got for you.
Yeah.
I can't take you any further with this.
House cleaning,
beep,
I think.
Beep.
Oh, you're done.
Beep, beep, beep.
Oh.
Hi, Patrick.
Oh, it sounds like your battery is running down. Is that what it is? Okay, all right. I'll either like wind you up at the back. Well, that's a little too old school. Instead, I'll pop in a little.
Yes, a little cell battery or something.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, well, Carol, thank you so much. What is on the cartoon slideshow this week?
We will have, there's still a steady stream of cartoons about Libya, Yemen, the whole Arab Spring. Still cartoons about Dominique Strauss-Kahn, about the E. coli scare, cartoons about Greece still needing a bailout, all sorts of stuff. And each week I'm introducing more and more cartoonists. So.
Great. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And you can check Carol's latest slideshow at theworld.org/cartoons. And if you want to see those lingo droids in action, go to theworld.org/language or to patrickcox.wordpress.com. I'll post links there to all of the other stories that we talked about as well. And there was one thing I forgot to mention while we were talking about the Obama story, and that is, guess where Barack Obama's parents met? Well, it was at the University of Hawaii in a Russian language class. Now, I know that for some people, that little fact has become the foundation of a highly evolved conspiracy theory involving who knows what, the Cold War, the Kremlin, the CIA, the White House, the Council on Foreign Relations, Africa. Well, for me, it's somewhat less grand. It's just reassuring to imagine the President of the United States' parents making eyes at each other in between you know, struggling with all of those verb forms. You could say their relationship progressed from the conjugational to the conjugal. Okay, I can see those eyes rolling. I better stop right now. You can post your comments at the World in Words Facebook page, or you can tweet me. My handle is Patrick Cox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X, or you can email me. The address is language@pri.org. More next week. See you then.